But we begin our program this evening by welcoming to our show People for the American Way's incoming president, Svante Mirek. He's previously served as the group's executive director and led campaigns focused on transforming public safety, racial equity, voting rights, and empowering young elected officials. Before joining People for the American Way, many of you may have heard of Svante, as he was the youngest mayor ever elected in the city of Ithaca, New York, where he served in office there for 10 years. People for the American Way's outgoing president, Ben Jealous, who's been a program or a guest on this program in the last year or so, is leaving to become the new executive director of the Sierra Club. But right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program Svante Mirek. Svante, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Oh, absolutely. Really appreciate you having me on, especially this holiday week. It's great to speak with you.
Yeah, well, I know it's a busy week for a lot of people, so I thank you.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, congratulations on your new position leading People for the American Way, an important group we've been in touch with for many years here on this program and, you know, really important to the politics as well as, you know, the progressive agenda of this country. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I've been a part of the People for the American Way family for 15 years or so myself. I was first elected to the city council in Ithaca. I was 20 years old, and I got an outreach from something called the Young Elected Officials Network. And I didn't know what they were, but the name was pretty self-explanatory. But it was when I found out that their parent organization was called People for the American Way, an organization that since 1980-ish has been fighting for truth, justice, and the American way, reclaiming patriotism and the flag for the left and trying to change politics by changing the culture. I jumped at the chance to be a part of it. And now 15 years later to be asked to lead it, it's quite the honor.
You know, before we get into our discussion of the very real and urgent threats to democracy that we have to deal with as a country, I wanted to know if you would be willing to share some of your own experience growing up poor and facing homelessness, and how that influenced you to dedicate your life to public service.
Well, sure, absolutely. I could tell you I'm very interested in hearing from your guest later this evening because of the way we did grow up. You know, my mom raised us. She did an amazing, incredible job working inside of a system that was really never set up for us to succeed. So I was born in 87. This was the height of the crack cocaine epidemic. And my father, who was in the Navy, got caught up with drugs. And the system just had all the wrong answers. You know, repeat incarceration for minor infractions. It was too hard to get medication, too hard to get treatment. And it never really worked for him, and it never really worked for our family. And so the first 6 months of my life, I ended up spending in a homeless shelter. And why? Because there weren't, you know, maternity protections. They weren't pregnancy or family leave protections for people with jobs. And because those who made minimum wage then as and now just don't make enough to get by. And it was because of my grandparents, who were both union teachers in a public school in a small place in upstate New York. They were able to help me, my mom, my siblings, make the slow, what's now been a 3-decade-long climb out of extreme poverty. But as I joked with, I told Ben on his way out, I said, you know, this is, I've been in the middle class for about 6 weeks now, and it is great. Two thumbs up, would highly recommend for everybody. And a middle-class standard of living is possible, of course, for everybody in this country if we had better policies and made it so. And that's part of our mission here, part of why I'm really excited, effective January 1st, to take over as president of People for the American Way, so I can help fight for that American dream.
Well, on that score, as you come into your new position, leading People for the American Way, and we won't spend too much time on this. I'm sure you're still formulating what your priorities are. But what are your top agenda items as you come into this new job?
Sure. It's really threefold. I mean, the first is to defend the truth. right now the truth is under attack, most alarmingly in our schools, but also in the media, where folks are trying to punish teachers for telling the true history, including all of the warts of America. People like Governor Youngkin in Virginia, DeSantis in Florida, trying to intimidate teachers, setting up snitch lines so that parents can get them in trouble for teaching what they call CRT or for even talking about homosexuality in the classroom, acknowledging its very existence. So from opposing book banning to opposing censorship, we want to fight over the truth. On justice, we are fighting not only to implement better police departments across the entire country with actual standards and the reforms that can help protect all people, but we also want to make sure that the Supreme Court justices, all the way down to district and circuit court justices, are as fair-minded, reasonable people as possible. So we're going to keep fighting for justice. And then the American way, which is, of course, our topic of discussion tonight, is all about democracy. The U.S. Constitution promises, well, after a few amendments, let's say as a black man, after a few amendments, that every person will have the right to vote and have their vote counted. And that's never been more under attack now. So we are, we have a whole suite of programs that defend democracy and the American way. So those three fights together are truth, justice, and the American way, just as Superman would have us fight for. That's what we'll be doing next year and through 2024.
All right. Well, we'll have to get that Clark Kent suit taken out of the closet there for you. Well, Cervante, as many of our listeners are well aware, the House committee investigating the January 6th coup attempt and insurrection, you know, they've been conducting that for some 17 months now. They released their final report, recommendations for policy changes and criminal referrals for the prosecution of former disgraced President Donald Trump. How would you assess the work of the committee and its effectiveness in informing the public about the multi-pronged attack on the election and Constitution organized by Trump?
Yeah. Well, I think the committee did incredible work under really, really tough conditions. They got concrete answers and from people who did not want to talk. They combed through a mountain of data, not just documents, text messages, and emails, but also video from a million different angles of the insurrection attempt on the 6th and of all of the streams and dark web activity leading up to the insurrection on January 6th. Not only did they compile all that information, but they presented it to the public in a way that, one, made it abundantly evident that a crime happened, and I believe the most dangerous crime of them all happened, which was an attempt to violently overthrow the United States government and replace it with an authoritarian and fascist regime, frankly. Not only did the January 6th committee prove that that is what happened, it's communicated, I think, pretty well to the public that that's what happened. You know, and this is sometimes the difference in government. I could say if somebody spent 15 years in government, often we can do good work, but we don't communicate it well. And I think the January 6th committee actually communicated pretty well its findings. And anybody who watched those hearings came away convinced of the truth.
Well said. You know, I did want to go on to ask you specifically about the criminal referrals. You know, regarding those criminal referrals made by the House January 6th committee, and I'll just list them briefly here. The first... it was the first criminal referral made by Congress against a former president in U.S. history, and it included the charges of conspiracy to defraud the federal government, obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to make a false statement, and inciting or assisting those in an insurrection. Now, it's pretty well known that these referrals don't hold any legal weight in and of themselves. It's up to the Department of Justice and Attorney General Merrick Garland to make a decision about prosecution of Donald Trump. And I believe John Eastman was also part of the criminal referral made by the committee. What are your concerns about the Department of Justice? They seem to have been lagging here in this committee. Yeah. In the House was often way in front of the Department of Justice as, in terms of some of the reporting we've heard. There's a concern that you may share that the Department of Justice is very reluctant and concerned about political fallout if they prosecute Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, because look, the committee, the January 6th committee, it knew what Peter Parker, speaking of superheroes, but Peter Parker and Spider-Man knew, which is that with great power comes great responsibility. And if you have the power to make a positive change and you don't do it, then the blame lays partly with you, right? And the January 6th committee, they knew, okay, that they didn't have the weight of the law. If they recommended charges, that doesn't mean the charges were necessarily going to happen. But they knew that this is a crime big enough, an attempt that was serious enough, that anybody who's in a position to speak out must do so. And so they took this charge up and they did it well. And I think I'm really, really concerned that the DOJ, which is obviously full of very smart people, might be outsmarting themselves. You know, they're thinking and attempting to do three-dimensional chess, four-dimensional chess, five-dimensional chess. They're saying, well, if we indict the president, that might make him the former president, that might make him a martyr, and therefore people will be... And I hope that that is not what's happening, because honestly, we need them to be as straightforward as possible. If they saw a crime in the planning and in the attempt, then they should charge the crime. Because, you know, I'm very pro, those who have followed my work may know that I'm extremely in favor of criminal justice reform, because I think it's too punitive and does not include enough space for actual reform and healing and the improvement of individuals. But the mountain of evidence here says that this was not a mistake or a one-off attempt, that this was, if anything, a dress rehearsal for attempts that could be made in the future. And whenever that's the case with a crime, whenever you can, by prosecuting, make it nearly guarantee that the same crime will not be attempted in the same form, you've got to do it. So the DOJ have to act here.
There are certainly concerns that if the Department of Justice decides not to proceed on criminal charges against Donald Trump for his central role in this attempted coup, that the rule of law in the United States itself will be in jeopardy. And as you said, that what happened on January 6th in 2021 could be just a dress rehearsal for the next time. What's at stake for the country and our democracy if the Department of Justice decides not to proceed on criminal charges related to January 6th and maybe goes in for the easier prosecution, and that would be the classified documents that Donald Trump kept at his Mar-a-Lago resort?
Yeah. Well, let me get just beyond, if I could, for a second. That's the right question. What's at stake? Let me get beyond the normal talking point about democracy and the rule of law and our system of government. Talk about what that actually means. If you live in America right now, it means you have some say in what happens in your town, in your county, in your state, in the country. There's a building being built next door, and you have an opinion about it, you can go to your planning commission. Your county is going to change the way it does trash pickup. You can write a letter. You can go and vote. Your governor tries to ban the woman's right to choose. You can stand up and speak out and fight that. If they pull this off, if they pull that off, then our right to be free citizens is over. All of what I just described is what's at stake. And that would be dangerous no matter the ideology that attempted it. If it was a far-left faction that was trying to delegitimize elections and just take the government by force, we should be concerned about that too. But I think it should be particularly concerning when we look at exactly what this faction wants. When it's a far-right, ultra-twisted form of Christo-fascism that views the only appropriate thing to be is a straight man, preferably white, and that every other category of person is somehow less human. I mean, that's to have those folks in charge of every aspect of American life is extremely dangerous. And that's what we're fighting against here. This is... They go back and check the committee hearing. If that sounds hyperbolic to those who are listening, check the tape and you'll find that that is exactly what they intended to do.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with People for the American Way's incoming president, and that's Savante Merrick. He's previously the youngest mayor ever elected to the city of Ithaca, New York, where he served for, where he served for 10 years. And we're very happy to have Savante Merrick in our program this evening. And Savante, I just wanted to ask you, among those who are not included in the criminal referrals from this committee, where Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, his chief of staff Mark Meadows, and Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, and then, of course, you have a whole political party, 147 Republicans who voted to overturn the election results on the evening of January 6th after the violence was quelled. It's dangerous, is it not, to prosecute maybe a few folks, but the bulk of politicians who were part, a key part of this attempt to overturn an election may go out, may be able to skate by without accountability.
Yeah, and I know exactly why you say that. I mean, look, in a criminal conspiracy, if you elect the foot soldiers, but leave those who planned, orchestrated it, designed the criminal conspiracy, if you leave them out in the field, not only is it unfair and unjust, but you actually won't get the impact that you're looking for, which is the prevention of another coup. And I think so long as particularly Trump and Eastman and those who are closest to Trump, as long as they are held responsible by the DOJ and the criminal justice system, I do think that we as a nation could then go about the business of holding those office holders accountable at the ballot box. You know, because, look, the truth is many of them, yes, represent gerrymandered districts, and many of them, yes, have at their backs the power of extremely, frankly, well-funded corporate special interests who will support their elections. But if we can do over these next 2 years, right, if we can fight in 2024 in particular, up and down the ballot, to make sure that authoritarianism does not return to power, then I think we can also pass sweeping voting rights legislation, including ending Citizens United. I mean, I think first standing up to protect our democracy, and then second, using that democracy to protect all of us is the way we go about this, and the way we get, as you said, those 140 plus lawmakers who were just fine and dandy with an attempted coup.
You know, there's another interesting group of people. We had a parade of these Republican White House officials come before the January 6th committee and provide testimony. My question, when seeing some of that testimony in those live hearings, was why didn't they speak out? It took a subpoena from the committee in order for them to tell the American public what was going on, but not one of them came forward and spoke up during the lead up to this coup that they were well aware of the details. It, to me, those folks are not heroes.
Well, remember, yeah, absolutely. I mean, remember, these are folks who were agreed to work in the Trump White House in the first place. So there's already a pretty clear issue of impaired moral judgment.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely is. You know, the bigger issue, and you spoke about this earlier, but there are a multitude of ongoing threats to our democracy, including white supremacist terrorist groups and the violence that they foment, attacks on communities of color, the LGBTQ gatherings. And then, of course, you've got the one of the major political parties in this country, the Republican Party, pursuing partisan and racial gerrymandering, voter suppression laws, and election subversion. What has to be done there? What is it that you'd like to see the country move toward in terms of addressing these threats to democracy that goes beyond January 6th?
Yeah. Well, I think it's of course, is up in some part to the federal government, who just did a good thing last week. And just like Democrats, we did a good thing on the least newsworthy day in America. I think we passed it on Christmas Eve. We passed the Electoral College Reform Act, which is a great, great piece of legislation that really tightens up any perceived legal holes in the very old 1880-something Electoral College Act. That helps, right? Federal legislation that shores up our election system, patches any holes in these institutions, funds things like election protection will be good. But democracy has to defend itself, right? And change, in this case, is not going to come from Washington, D.C. It really is the responsibility of people who live in really important swing states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, and all states in the country to be fighting to volunteer and work at polling places, to be writing letters to the county board of elections to make sure that polling places in poor counties and in poor regions and in predominantly black regions are not underfunded, right? To make sure that everybody on your block and everybody that you know knows that they have the right to vote and that they get out and do vote. You know, this is not a spectator sport. And democracy is intended to be a self-cleaning system, which is to say it works if you work it. So, you know, if you want to be part of that work at People for the American Way, you can join us. You can just find our website, Googling People for the American Way. But from the League of Women Voters, the League of Conservation Voters, to organizations as diverse as the Sierra Club or the NAACP, there are a ton of folks who feel this way and are working around the country to defend our democracy. So we don't have to wait for the good news to come from some sort of Senate hearing. We can do this ourselves.
You know, Svante, I did want to touch on, while we still have a few minutes left, the issue of disinformation. You spoke a little bit earlier this evening about our media and how it often has become a vehicle for disinformation. And that was brought home recently with a testimony of Sean Hannity, one of the stars of the Fox News bubble. I was struck by the fact that he said, truthfully or not, to the folks at the January 6th committee that he didn't believe a word of anything about a stolen election. But there he was, night after night, promoting it. And certainly he had a role, I think, in fomenting a lot of emotion and very likely the violence that some people perpetrated on January 6th. What do you think about our media system and, you know, the calls by some for censorship? But, of course, I think most people in this country want to uphold the First Amendment, our free speech rights, without resorting to censorship. But disinformation, disinformation on politics and the disinformation and anti-science misinformation that we see spread about vaccines and COVID have been deadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and there's always been the case that, you know, it is a danger of a free press that bad information is sometimes, is often broadcast wildly. But it's a danger that we have to accept, I think, largely, as you were alluding to. Getting in and censoring what a meathead like Sean Hannity says, difficult. But what we can all do is play our own part, you know? What does our own media diet look like? And how much are we doing to inform our own neighbors and friends and family about the true state of the world? Again, this is not intended to be, but when I say this, I mean politics, I mean government, I mean media. None of it's intended to just be consumed. That's not the way our system was designed. Our system is designed to function properly if everybody participated. If those who can spot the truth from a lie are part of the public discourse, writing letters to the newspaper, you know, texting your friends, calling your representatives, and voicing your displeasure. Yes, this includes voicing your displeasure with advertisers who support dangerous and deadly misinformation. We do those things, then we can be part of the solution instead of, you know, bemoaning the problem. I say that to somebody, of course, who on the airwaves familiar with the work, and you are yourself part of the solution. every night that you're on.
Well, thank you for that. And we're just about out of time. And Sivan, again, congratulations on the new position, leading People for the American Way. And leave our listeners, if you would, with the web address or any other resources you'd like our listeners to know about as they engage in the fight for democracy.
Well, much of it, really appreciate it. You know, for four decades, since our founding by the TV producer Norman Lear, who I was just with last week, helping celebrate his 100th birthday, we've been on the front lines of fights for increased civil and human rights. And I do hope folks will be interested in joining us at pfaw.org. That is peopleforTheAmericanWay.org. And, of course, it's almost the end of the year. And I've been informed that as my duties as incoming president is to help raise as much grassroots funding as we can. So if you'd like to shoot us $5, $10, $15, please do now. And I'll just take credit for that next year.
Okay. Well, thanks again for being here. And best of luck in the new position. I'm sure we'll be asking to schedule a conversation again soon. But take care and happy new year to you and everybody at People for the American Way.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Sivante Mirek. He's the new leader of the incoming president, I should say, of the group People for the American Way, formerly mayor for 10 years of the New York city of Ithaca.